Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode. Follow me up on Instagram. I'm at Kevin Rose there. You can see all my shenanigans there. Or you can also, not or, but also you can go in and leave a 5-star review if you enjoy this podcast, which I think you're going to love this episode. I'm so glad and thrilled that you hit play on this one because it is one of my recent favorites. Chris Voss is the author of a book called Never Split the Difference. It's all about negotiation. He spent 24 years in the FBI. He was the chief international hostage and kidnapping negotiator. So he has a ton of experience. And really what this book taught me is that negotiation is so much deeper than I thought. I always thought, you know, you sit down at the table with your opponent and you kind of haggle back and forth on price and eventually you find something that feels comfortable and you agree and you get on with your life. That was a completely naive approach to this whole thing. There are so many little tactics and proven psychology that you can deploy when you're negotiating with someone to get a better price. There are so many times when we use negotiation that we just don't even think about it. Like, for example, I mean, there's the obvious stuff, right? Where you just want a better price on a car. But there's other things like maybe you want a raise at your job, or maybe you want to approach the person at the desk and try and get an upgraded seat on that flight that you're about to get on. Or maybe you're at a department store and there's no sales, but you'd like a slight discount on something. There's just 1,000 little ways that you can enter into a negotiation. And a lot of this is all about the psychology, the information gathering, and the bond that you're creating with your opponent. So really, the first half of this podcast is about some tactics that we get into to create a deeper connection with the person you're negotiating with. And this is critical. So we get into something called mirroring, how you can mirror the person that makes them feel like they're being heard. We get into something called labeling, how you can label their emotions so that they also feel like they're getting heard. It builds up that trust with that person. Why you should beware of the word yes. You actually don't want to hear the word yes. Why you should avoid the word fair. We also talk about round numbers, how round numbers don't seem like they're considered. So for example, we'll get into this later, but I'll just give you a quick example. If you wanted to pay $20 for something, you would never just say, I'll give you $20, because that just seems like some kind of random round number versus if you said, gosh, you know, I can give you $19.25. That sounds very considered. That sounds like you've put some thought into it. That sounds like that's the maximum you could possibly go. And so that tends to make the other party think and believe that that is your best offer. So there's little tiny tricks and tips like that all sprinkled throughout this podcast that I think you'll enjoy. And the book is phenomenal too. I got to tell you, this podcast is going to be great. And it's a great little primer for you, but go back, get the book and do what I did and just like highlight the crap out of it. You'll learn a ton. Anyway, ton of great information here. Really hope you enjoyed the show.
I think the best place to start would be just to cover your background. Like, how did you get started in negotiation? Was this something that you studied in school? Obviously, you had it, used it in your professional career, but I'd love to hear the entire story.
Yeah, you know, and it was really kind of an accident. In hindsight, I do remember picking up Herb Cohen's book, You Can Negotiate Anything, when I was in college and thinking that was really interesting. So I think I was really interested in, you know, verbal communication. But when I was in law enforcement, I just wanted to be a SWAT guy. I was on a list to be transferred to the SWAT team, Kansas City Police Department, KCMO, when I took the job with the FBI. So I was poised to go to the PD SWAT team. And then I actually went to the SWAT team when I was with Pittsburgh in the FBI, and I transferred to New York and tried out for the FBI's hostage rescue team, which is their version of the Navy SEALs and, you know, former SEALs and Delta guys on that team, and re-injured my knee and had my ligament reconstruction again.
Oh, geez.
And figured, you know, there's only so many times that that could be done, which is true. And so I thought, well, I want to stay in crisis response, and he's probably not going to hold up to the beating over the years. You know, let me do with the negotiators. They go out with the SWAT team. You know, those guys don't hurt their knee. They, you know, they sit around and talk. That can't be that hard. You know, typical attitude of the SWAT guys, you know, the negotiators talk. What good is that? It can't be hard. And then I got into it, and it was amazing. It resonated with me more than anything else that I'd ever done. So, you know, as a result of something bad, the knee injury, something phenomenal came out of it. It led me to hostage negotiation.
And when you first join that crew, what is the onboarding like for that? Is that something where they send you off to school? Like, how do they bring you up to speed? Because I'd imagine, you know, you come into something like that, and you think you know what negotiation is, but is there a playbook for that at that point?
Yeah, you know, and you really do think you know, and you really don't know at all, which is the great thing about the magic of negotiation. Like, great negotiation is utterly invisible. So the onboarding is, if you get selected to go, you know, your local field division, I happen to be in New York, they got to pick you for the team. You know, you get in line and then you wait for Quantico, you know, the mystical Quantico, to open up a position for someone from New York or whatever division you're at to go. And you go down there and, man, they drop you right in. They really help you understand that you got no idea what you were getting into. And it's pretty cool because it's the only in-service CFBI teaches where outsiders are there. Normally, you go to an in-service at the academy, you're kind of like, it's gone to the academy. It's a boring place. I got to go through this. And you show up first morning at the negotiation course, and there are hostage negotiators, cops from across the country, cops from around the world. And you're kind of like, wow, this is different. And if they're there, they're either leader, the cops, they're either the leader where they came from, or they were involved in some horrific situation, or both. And so you sit next to guys, and you suddenly find yourself as a member of this international fraternity, if you will, that saves lives. And it's really cool.
How do you accurately, like, if you're doing just role playing, how do you make sure that it's, you know, you're actually getting to the real emotions that would happen in a real negotiation versus something that's just taught in the classroom? Because I'd have to imagine it. That's, you know, doesn't feel like the same thing to me.
That is 1,000% the problem. And I already knew that in advance going in. And we actually solved that because, you know, you got to do emotional negotiation in business. The reason I knew it going in is I had spent a couple of years volunteering on a suicide hotline, which is a masterclass on emotional intelligence. And so then I knew what real emotional reactions sounded like. So I didn't have to learn it. In training, it's very difficult. If you don't have a role player with you who really understands what would happen, a really seasoned trainer, you get a lot of false reads because people are not being themselves. And the way we solve that, you know, when we're teaching this in business situations, you know, we have people talk about stuff that's important to them. Because you're going to react genuinely. Like I ask you, you know, what's important to you? You're going to say motorcycle riding. And I'm going to say, well, what about motorcycle riding is important to you? And when you begin to talk, then I'm going to use the skills to like dig deep into that. And then the advantage is when I find out about your passions, that actually reveals your core values to me, which is the essence of any great relationship, let alone a business relationship. You know, mm-hmm. What's important to you? You know, is it family? Is it loyalty? Is it freedom? Is it spontaneity? You go on a motorcycle because it's the only time you get a chance to unwind and you feel dedicated to your family. You need 45 minutes to yourself. Whatever I dig into you, and it's only going to take me about 3 minutes, I get a clear snapshot of who you are and how we can interact together.
Yeah, that's one of the fascinating things that when I first started getting into your book that I really loved was, you know, initially I would always think of negotiation as just something that, you know, I put that hat on. Okay, I'm in negotiation mode. You know, I'm like ready to do this. And you go in and it's very brute force. And one of the things that, you know, you had mentioned very early on in the book is that negotiation is more about information gathering. Why is that important? Why is it important to really get to that core kind of emotional level first with the person you're chatting with?
Yeah, well, the information gathering process, and a lot of people, that's what really distinguishes how we teach this. Because, you know, I mentioned Herb Cohen's book before, way back when, you know, his definition of negotiation is the use of information and power in a web of tension. That web of tension would be emotions, right? Which he didn't know that then, but he was always a very insightful guy. We didn't have emotional intelligence as a term. That's the web of tension. It's always there. Now, the distinction was, Herb said, the use of information. And we're talking about gathering information. And once you get to the table, you know, there's so much more information. The other side's dying to tell you if you can get them to tell you. You know, like if, let's say you researched them on LinkedIn. Well, that's your dating profile, right? You're not going to find out about somebody who they really are from the Match.com profile. So all the information that you can gather on people on the web, while it's useful, they're going to tell you so much more if you get them on the phone, if you interact with them. So how do you dig into that much faster? And that really ends up becoming the issue. And it's not a brute force thing, like what you just said. It's about great collaboration.
Mm-hmm. So you start off, how do you build that kind of confidence and that rapport initially? I know that you had mentioned, you know, mirroring being a big part of that. Is that right? Is that when you bring in mirroring into the equation?
Yeah, it might be mirroring. It might be labeling. I mean, it might be summarizing. The real key is actually listening. There's no negotiation book out there that doesn't list listening as an advanced skill. And mm-hmm. almost everybody says, I go around hearing people all day. You know, I can do that. And it's not the case. So that's actually a great competitive advantage because we're all used to not being listened to. Mm-hmm. You know, I read an article from the head of marketing for Facebook probably about 5 years ago. And the essence of the article was he's sick of not being listened to. He's sick of having salespeople, contracts people, everybody ask him questions, not listen to his answers. So I'm like, if you ain't going to listen to my answer, I'm not going to answer. So what does that mean? What that means is if you actually listen to the person that you're talking to, they're going to be so astonished in a wonderful way that the chances that they start just downloading tons of important information on you are really high because nobody else is listening to them. So it might be mirroring, it might be labeling.
Yeah. So let's I mean, obviously there's listening can be just shutting up for a minute, like letting someone like, you know, just go off and tell you things, but how do you confirm that emotionally? How do you let someone know? I mean, maybe we can start with mirroring, but how do you let someone know that they are being listened to?
Yeah. And that's a great question because we're trained to do the opposite. You know, we're trained, if we're unsure, to keep our mouth shut, by and large. You know, there's a saying, you know, you keep your mouth shut, let people wonder if you're stupid, or you can open your mouth and remove all doubt. So we get this fear of being wrong, when in fact, the essence of it is being willing to be wrong. Like, if you're talking to me, and I can hear that this sounds important to you, I can say, hey man, you know, sounds like this is important to you, or sounds like you've given us a lot of thought. And you're going to feel like I'm keying into you. I am paying attention to you. And even with that opening, you're going to give me a lot more information. Like, you're going to respond enthusiastically or not, which gives me more evidence. This is investigation. I was training a class of real estate agents just over the last 2 days. I said, look at this as an investigation. And with each reaction, you get, you know, they react some more. They're going to tell you some more. And it's okay to be wrong, because if you're wrong, people correct you. And correction might as well be one of the seven deadly sins, man. Mm-hmm. People love to correct.
Yeah.
It's so satisfying. And the cool thing about that is when somebody corrects you, they're probably giving you ridiculously honest information.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. So it one of the things I like about what you said there, when it sounds like, can you talk about those choice of words? Because that's part of labeling someone's emotions. I know in the book you say, you know, it seems like, it sounds like, it looks like. Why those words?
Yeah, that's a critical choice. And I'm impressed that you picked up on it. All right. So the simplicity of this design is very deceptive. First of all, it's a verbal observation, which then invites the other person to think about what you just said. It triggers thinking in the other side. What it does is kind of bypasses the prefrontal cortex, which is a traffic cop of the brain, as opposed to evaluating whether or not they're going to respond. When you say it like that, they just start thinking. And consequently, when they'll start to think out loud, which gives you a lot more unvarnished information. Mm-hmm. The other great thing about that, too, is, first of all, we're intentionally avoiding the use of the word I. You know, we're not teaching people to say what I'm hearing is. because then that makes your communication self-centered. As soon as you use the word I, you don't want that. It interrupts their pattern mm-hmm. in their head. And it gives you an automatic fallback. And, you know, in the 1 in a million chance that you were wrong, they say, I didn't say that. That's not right. You go like, wow, yeah, man, I didn't say that was true. I said that's the way it seems. And an observation on your part is inarguable. You can be corrected, but you can always say, look, you know, that's what it seems like. That's the way it looks from here. And that it becomes then much more inarguable, and they don't have to get upset. And, I once said to a guy, you know, you sound angry, man. He came back and said, I'm not angry. And I said, whoa. I didn't say you were angry. I said, you sound angry. And he calmed down instantly.
Hmm.
And then he came up to me the next day and said, hey, man, I appreciate your insight. A lot of people misread me.
Wow. When does mirroring come into play? Is that used to get people to speak more? Like, let's say they stop and they kind of like freeze up, or they stop talking. What does mirroring actually do, and how does someone use it?
They freeze up.
So that's just like the question. You basically just did it on me. I love that.
And how did it feel when I did that to you just now?
I wanted to answer back.
Yeah, you suddenly you feel drawn to answer, right?
Yeah.
Almost involuntarily. And so that's the cool thing about mirroring. I mean, you know, we teach people it's repeating the last 1 or 3 words of what someone just said, or when you get good at it, you practice it enough time, you can pick out a specific 1 to 3 words.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it does is the other side just feels like they want to say more. And they want to reward it, and they want to add to it. You know, my son Brandon, he's our chief negotiator, cuts all our deals. He says, he calls it connectors. He says it helps people connect thoughts in their head, and they begin to think out loud even more. And the critical issue there, they probably re-describe it with different words, because it's a better way of saying, what did you mean by that? Because if you ask me what I meant by that, I'm going to say it again with the exact same words, only louder.
Right.
And so then that's the first thing, is that people feel very drawn to it. They want to talk. The other great thing about it is if you do it enough times so that you wire the synapse in your head, you know, you create the skill, you create the habit, about 63 tries, 63 reps. It's also a great thing that when you're completely caught off guard, like if you were shocked with what the person just said.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know, and you're just so shocked you don't know what to say. And, you know, we got a YouTube channel, the Black Swan Group, and I got a mirroring video up there. And I got a recording from a hostage negotiation, a bank robbery that actually I was a hostage negotiator. I'm talking to a bad guy. And he said something about a getaway driver and the getaway van that shocked me. I didn't know that there was even a guy that had gotten away. And he says, we chase your driver away? He said, you chase my driver away. And I was so blown away by that. I mean, I didn't know anything about a driver. I don't know what the heck he's talking about. I mean, right. my brain literally locks up in a moment. And so I just mirror him because I built the skill. It was a great way to buy time when you're shocked.
Gotcha.
And I go, we chase your driver away? He said, yeah. When he saw the police, he cut and run. And that we had no idea of an accomplice that had gotten away at that point in time. With him blurting that out accidentally, and he was a real control freak guy. That may have been the only thing he blurted out accidentally in 12 hours. The investigators on the outside tracked the guy down, locked him up, and then that spontaneous admission ended up being a critical piece of evidence that caused the getaway driver to have to plead guilty to being involved.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a cool video. I mean, and I got to tell you, another portion I got in the video is, I'm trying to train somebody to mirror, just like you and I were. So the guy, he decides he's going to be kind of a smart aleck, and he's going to mirror me in the midst of the conversation, and I don't even see it. And so he gets me completely off guard, and I'm answering his question, and he goes, wait a minute, did I just do it? Or are you responding to my mirror?
That's amazing.
And I'm like, how dare you?
That's awesome. Now, when you in the book, you mentioned beware of yes, like just the word yes.
Yes.
Yes. Tell me about that word and why it's so dangerous.
Yeah. And there's a lot of words that depend upon which side we are on it. our reaction is so differently, it might as well be in a foreign language. Like when you're trying, when you get somebody to say yes to you, I mean, you want to sing opera, the heavens part, the choirs, the angels, the birds are chirping, the sun is shining. I mean, it's addictive. But the flip side of it is, you know, there's this nonsense out there called the yes momentum or momentum selling. And they say every little yes you get is a tie down. And lawyers call it cornering. And so you tie them down with each little yes. They're micro agreements. Then they have to say yes to the big yes. Well, that's inherently insulting. And it may have worked with us back when we were 15 years old. But it's been done to each one of us so many times that the minute anybody tries to get you to say yes as to even what day it is, you're like, where is this going? What's the trap? What kind of tie down is this? What are you trying to lure me into? And it's so invisible because we love hearing it. I may be speaking to a group of 500 people and I'll say, oh, really? You guys think this is okay? How many of you react with delight when somebody calls you on the phone and says, have you got a few minutes to talk? What's your reaction? And everybody feels a bad feeling in a pit of the stomach. And usually at least a third of the people in the room will go, no. And I'm like, wait a minute. I thought you loved yes. You know, why doesn't somebody say, have you got a few minutes to talk? Why don't you react with the same way as when you hear yes? Why don't you say, yes, thank God you called. I want to say yes. It makes me feel so good.
Yeah.
And because it's not, because we know it's a trap. That's the problem.
So what is it, you know, when I think of negotiation, I guess it really depends on what you're trying to negotiate. I mean, if you're coming to a final deal, like you did on your Forerunner that you, which I'd love to get into. Was it the Forerunner that you negotiated? Yeah. Using the
My
book?
Yeah. Salsa Red Pearl.
Do you still have that?
I do. I'm going to keep that truck to the day I die.
Yeah, we got to talk about that because I thought that was a fun practical example that, that a lot of people could use. But, you know, when they finally say yes at the very end and they agree on the price, that's different than what we're talking about here. You're talking about the little micro yeses before the big agreement. Is that right?
Aha, aha. Yeah, that's a line from an Eddie Murphy movie way back when. Sorry, I'm old. All right, but no, here's what we do. Like, I do not close on yes. I'll give you a classic example. When it's important, I hate the word yes. There's too many fake yeses. There's too many times that people back up. I mean, I have no use for the word. So how do I make this happen? I get introduced to Robert Herjavec from Shark Tank, which is a side note. He is an awesome guy. He's ridiculously generous. He cares about everybody who works for him. He's got a great company. I mean, I could go on for 20 minutes about what a cool dude Robert Herjavec is. Very genuine, decent dude. And on top of that, he bought me lunch, which means he's a great guy.
Nice.
But we got a training. My company, we do training events across the country. And they're expensive. I'm here to tell you, you want to train with us in person, it's going to cost you a lot of money. But I'm offering Herjavec a free ticket. Now, I don't think he's going to come. I think he's going to send one of his guys, which, you know, I want to, you know, I'd love to have him as a client. His awesome response instead of a thank you very much was, how many can we buy? Which, again, is another sign of a generous dude. Mm-hmm. So we're going back and forth on how many he's going to buy. And we're selling out. Now, my team is mad at me for giving anything away because these tickets are expensive. And they don't care that it's a famous guy from TV. They could care less that it's Robert Herjavec. They're mad that I'm giving him a seat and he's not committing for the tickets. So I get an email on a Tuesday. I'm in LA. My team's on the East Coast. And I say, you get Herjavec to commit to those seats and buy them now, or we're cutting off all sales and he doesn't get any, because by the time the sun comes up tomorrow, we're going to be sold out. Mm-hmm. So it's the end of the day in LA, which means we're 3 hours behind New York. It's at 5:00. I have to get a decision. I got to close Herjavec and I got to close him now. And the end of the day may be the worst time to close. So I sent him an email that says, are you against committing to 3 tickets now? Are you against paying for them before the business day starts in New York tomorrow? I get an email back less than 15 minutes later. He says, no. I says, we'll commit to three right now. Send me a link right now. My assistant will be in touch with you. We'll pay for them within the hour. 5 minutes later, I got an email from his assistant. I send her the link. 5 minutes later, they're paid.
So what do you attribute that to? Is that because it was a very specific ask? It wasn't just, it was an actionable thing to do versus just saying like, you know, do you still want these tickets? Which someone could just write back and say, yes.
Yeah, well, exactly. But the problem is, yes, people always hesitate. They want to think through for at least 24 hours what they're getting themselves into. Mm-hmm. And in that 24 hours, something else is going to distract them and they're going to go off to the side. Now, as stupid as it sounds, and this is not the only thing we teach, but this is enough of a game changer that people begin to instantly make a difference in their lives with this. No always causes you to feel safe and protected when you say it. If you feel safe and protected, you center and you can evaluate rationally more the options. And your answer is either going to be no, I'll do it now, or no. What's even better is when they say no, but here are the obstacles. And they will lay out for you the very specific obstacles and they will remove all doubt from you as to how to proceed. Because a yes, but, and they are afraid to lay out obstacles after yes because they feel like any more information I give is further commitment and I might not be ready to commit. If I say no, but you got to fix these things first, you come back to me and fix them. They still feel like, look, I never said yes, so I haven't committed to this deal yet. Although, because you did those things, they will.
Right. So what about getting someone, rather than saying yes, you mentioned that you really prefer them to say that's right.
That's the other thing, too. Getting a no might not be enough. And frequently, it's not. And so when somebody says that's right to you, that's when they feel completely heard and they also feel bonded to you. I had somebody at a conference tell me once, I think when somebody says that's right, they're telling you they feel empathy from you. Mm-hmm. And that's very compelling. There's no better relationship than an empathy-based relationship. We call it trust-based influence. And trust-based influence of people in your lives, you talk to them once a year, but you trust them so much, you resonate them so much, it was like you spoke to them yesterday. Yeah. You don't have to spend a lot of time with nonsensical chit-chat and catching up. You get right down to business.
Yeah, I feel like using that's right can actually be useful in just a social setting as well. Like even if you're not negotiating something and someone says something to you that you agree with, that's right just feels like so much deeper and more of a connection to the person than just answering with a simple yes. You're like reaffirming.
Yeah. Yeah. You're telling them you're all in on what they just said.
Right.
And you don't mean to feel that much, but when you're all in, I mean, like we're on the same sheet of music, you know, we got each other, at least on this, we are completely together on this. Yeah. It's very compelling.
One of the pieces of that I thought was fascinating, one of the little tricks, and you have a ton of these little tricks that I picked up in the book that I love, but and we'll get into the round numbers one in a second, which I think is fascinating. But one of the ones I like is your tone of voice trick. You talk about when to shift your tone of voice and how to use that, you know, that DJ type voice. How did you figure that out? Like, was that something they taught you in the FBI? I mean, how did you figure out tone of voice actually matters?
Yeah, you know, I really stumbled over that by complete accident because, you know, I was told to become a hostage negotiator, I need to go volunteer on a suicide hotline. So I'm like, all right, you know, if I'm giving good advice, I'm one of the rare people that take it, which has made a huge difference in my life. So many people don't take advice from the right people. So I'm on a hotline and I'm a little nervous and I don't know what happened, but I naturally, because of my nervousness or focus on getting it right, I immediately stumbled into what we now refer to as late night FM DJ voice. And I remember the first call I took on a line, the line was helpline. And I just said, hello, this is helpline. And, you know, it's your first call. You got a supervisor and they tell you how you did afterwards. And they were like, man, that tone of voice is great. I mean, that was awesome. You just dialed into that person right away and they felt like you were there for them. And wow, that was awesome. And I remember thinking like, I have no idea what I did. I am completely oblivious to it. I'm going to have to go. I'll try it again. And only this time I'll actually listen to myself. And so I got great nurturing feedback to do that. And I learned what an advantage it was. And so I was teaching it on as a hostage negotiator. And then one day, a psychiatrist who was also a hypnotherapist comes up to me and he says, man, that's the first thing they taught us when we learned hypnosis. Hmm. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I don't know if I'm calming them down or if I'm hypnotizing them, but here's some real good feedback that this is an awesome tool. Yeah, and that's how I got onto it. And then those of us that were really interested in raising our level of our game to master level, every person who masters something masters the basics first. That's where real mastery comes from. And all the people that I respect the most in negotiation, one of them is part of my team, Derek Gaughan, love tonality. Hmm. And that was why we resonated so much early on, because he was a master practitioner and he appreciated tonality as much as I did.
I get that in the hostage negotiation scenario, you know, tensions are high. Same with the suicide hotline. But what about just, you know, everyday business? Say you're going to negotiate that forerunner again. Do you think tone of voice also matters there?
1,000%, but here's the spin difference. Hostage negotiator's tone of voice should be the late night FM DJ about 90% of the time. And about 10% of the time, maybe the smiling voice, the playful voice. You know, I'm smiling right now and you can feel a smile in my voice.
Yeah.
You flip that dynamic in business and personal interactions. Most of the mm-hmm. time you should be smiling. But every now and then you gotta say something that the other side's really gotta listen to. Like, you know, something you're not gonna do. And you don't wanna back them into a corner. But you need them to chill out over this because you're not going to do it. You know, for us, for example, we don't do work for hire clauses in contracts. So I'll just say we don't do work for hire, and they'll get it.
Yeah. So you just drop it. So the ability to dynamically go either up to that smiley style or down to the more serious DJ style in real time, basically.
Yeah, in the moment. And then I'll tell you the other thing. The only thing I learned from The Wolf of Wall Street, and I'm willing to learn from anybody. You know, I picked up his book. The guy owes $100 million in restitution to people he stole from. Now, you don't owe $100 million without being good at something. You know,
yeah.
If you owed $100 million, he took a heck of a lot more than that, and he still owes that restitution, which if you buy the book and you don't want to buy the book of a guy that committed crimes like that, at least you're helping him pay his restitution. So that's how I reconciled myself to buying his book.
Yeah.
But his magic was inflection. And when I got to the seventh chapter, because I'm wondering, how does this guy do this? I mean, I'm looking at his sales system, and I'm like, there's nothing special here. Mm-hmm. And his conversion rates are really, really low. Our conversion rates exceed his in any day of the week. And we're not ripping people off. Mm-hmm. But what's he doing? And I get to the chapter on tonality, and I knew that was it. He had mastered tonality. He knew how to make different tone changes. And, you know, and the real key to what I learned from him was his upward inflection at a time that catches you off guard. Like, you could say to somebody, you know, when I mentioned this before, it doesn't sound like you were listening. And if I say it in that tone of voice, I'm kind of insulting you. My tone of voice is saying like, hey, dopey, you weren't listening. And
right.
But I could say it again. And I could say, when I mentioned this before, it seems like you weren't listening. Now that lands completely differently.
Right.
You don't feel like I'm calling you a name. You feel like I'm sort of mystified, and you're more engaged.
Right.
That's another, that tonality is a superpower when you really understand it.
Crazy. There's so many things. Like the thing about your book is I started off on audiobook and I went through it and I was like, gosh, I'm taking down little notes and I'm like, screw it. I got to buy the physical copy so I can actually write in the book because there's so many little tricks and tips in there that I think it, cool. It's important to go back and reference.
Thank you.
You know, you said one of the things I thought was brilliant is you talk about the word fair. And you don't like the word fair, right?
It's the F word.
It's the F word.
It's the F word. Well, it's the F bomb.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is so common in everyone that negotiates, like whether you be at a garage sale or trying to buy a vehicle or whatever it is, you say, well, that sounds fair. That seems fair. Why should we avoid this word?
The F bomb. Yeah, it's shocking when you look for it. It's dropped in nearly every negotiation. Mm-hmm. You know, the sharks do it because they know it catches off guard. Like a cutthroat negotiator says, look, we've given you a fair offer. You immediately doubt yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't know it. It's the slickest way to accuse someone of being unfair that there is. And it causes such self-doubt. And I've seen people raise their counteroffers and bargain against themselves only by saying like, hey, you know, we just want what's fair. We've given you a fair offer. And it just knocks people off mm-hmm. their feet. It's, you know, we got a piece out there. Again, my son wrote it. You know, thank God he's on my team because he's really good. You know, he says the four most emotional words in negotiation are leverage, price, value, and fair. Because each one of those words triggers so many emotional responses that we're not really aware of. Mm-hmm. And a cutthroat negotiator will use it to catch you off balance. Or if you're not a cutthroat negotiator, but somehow you feel it's not working out, you go like, that's not fair. And it adds so many negative emotions into mm-hmm. a negotiation. And negative emotions constrict our thinking. It's not emotions that are bad for negotiations. It's negative emotions. Mm-hmm. And understanding that distinction immediately gives you a leg up on everybody else. And, you know, a negative emotion would be anger. There's a saying, if you make a speech when you're angry, it'll be the greatest speech you'll ever regret. Mm-hmm. So fair triggers negative emotions. It constricts people's thinking and contributes to bad decision making. And because it does, the people that are trying to take advantage of it know that and they use it against us.
So would you ever use that in any scenario? Would you ever say this is a fair deal or would you ever say that word to anyone?
I would never say it's a fair deal. What I would say is because I know it's coming. I know the F word is going to get dropped at some point in time by the other side. Mm-hmm. So if a train's coming at me, I'm an idiot if I stay on the tracks. And so how do I get off the tracks? I will say when we get started, especially if I expect the negotiation to be contentious, mm-hmm. I would say, look, I want you to feel treated fairly every step of the way. And if at any point in time I say anything that feels unfair, we're going to stop and we're going to go back and we're going to address it. Now, because I do need to know if I'm off track, if I'm triggering negative emotions, if I'm off track with you, because implementation is the real issue. And if you feel you've been treated unfairly, you're going to just slaughter me with, you know, you're going to dig in your heels on implementation. You're going to hit me with passive aggression every opportunity you get. You're not going to comply. You're going to cost me a ton of dough.
Yeah.
So I don't need that.
Yeah, that actually loops back to what you were saying about that's right versus yes. You know, like how deep of commitment are you really getting? Like, are they really actually going to follow through and implement everything that you're talking about versus just, you know, saying yes lightly?
Yeah, when the devil's in the details, the devil's in implementation, and that's where you make your money. And so that's exactly right. That's right.
Love it.
So you got me to say that's right.
Yeah. One of the things I like is when you say, I like how you like preemptively use fair in a positive context early on. So you have to, that somewhat sidesteps and avoids it later. But when it's being used against you, let's say someone just drops it on you, one of the things that you say in the book is you can respond with, it seems like you're ready to support that.
Yeah.
And so talk to me about how that counteracts, you know, the fair statement that was just thrown at you.
Yeah, well, let's just draw it out in the open. What the data that I need to gather at this point in time is, are you trying to cut my throat or do you really feel that it's unfair? Mm-hmm. Those are two very different cats underneath, but on the surface may look exactly the same. I got to do an investigation. I got to know what I'm dealing with. So let me, my observation is going to, like, that seems like you can support that. Encourages them to let me know where the problems are. If they have a genuine feeling of unfairness, they're going to lay it out for me. Or if they're going to sort of sputter and I go like, you're going to watch it unfold in front of you. You're going to see them think it out loud. Now, if it's a throat cutter, he's going to clam up on me instantly. He's not going to answer and he's not going to say anything. He's not going to struggle with his thought pattern. He's going to know he was caught.
Now, what do you mean by a throat cutter?
You know, the guy who is just trying to take you for everything you got and doesn't mm-hmm. care about the relationship.
Gotcha.
You know, he's got, you know, another tell of a throat cutter, if you're comfortable with the terminology from poker, you know, poker tell. If in the first 5 minutes of our conversation, the person on the other side says to me, look, we want to do a win-win deal here. That's a throat cutter. That mm-hmm. guy is trying to pick my pocket.
Crazy. So how do you, if you know you're dealing with a great segue into the types of negotiators that there are, because one of the chapters, and I think this for me was the hardest thing to wrap my head around, but you have to actually go in and understand the type that you're negotiating with. Is that right?
Well, you know, we each got a default type. It's fight, flight, make friends. It's from the caveman days. The world splits pretty evenly into thirds. Now, when you run into an impasse, it's usually as a result of a type mismatch. Mm-hmm. And although the two of you think you're speaking the same language, you're not. Because each type places a premium on something different. They're, you know, the make friends type, they're relationship oriented. That's the only thing they care about. Mm-hmm. The fight guy, you know, he just wants to give a good accounting of himself. He wants to make sure you know where he's coming from. I'm a natural born fight guy. I'm direct and honest because I want you to know where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. The flight guy, this is a highly analytical dude. This is a dude that sees conflict as just an utter waste of time. They're, you know, and they're the closest to the late night FM DJ voices. The default, they seem distant, they seem aloof. They don't see themselves as distant and aloof and cold as they're often read as being. But they're data driven, and because that, they, you know, they play everything close to the vest. And of course, if you misread them, they're so analytical, they don't care because they think you're a dope for misreading them.
So with all these different types, you obviously have slightly different strategies on how to engage with them, which I thought was great. One of the things I'd love to get into is really picking a scenario that you like, that you've done in the past, a real world example. It could be the Forerunner one if you are into that, but one that kind of walks us through each of these things, like the mirroring, the labeling, and kind of like your own personal journey on how you negotiated that situation. Do you have an example that you like?
Yeah, no, we could do the Forerunner. That'd be fun.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I think that applies to a lot of people. Like, we've all been in that seat where we want an awesome car, and mostly I've been screwed in the past. So I'd love to hear how you would approach something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, tactical empathy. I'm laying a lot of heavy duty tactical empathy on this guy. And then I'm saying no in the gentlest way possible that just leaves very many people just completely flummoxed. They don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, first tell me about the car. You got to start there.
Yeah, man.
What did you see?
Like, first of all, I'm willing to admit I lusted for a Toyota for a long time. This is back in 2006. And Toyota was at the top of the game. There was solid gold standard as far as I was concerned. I'd had an American-made SUV for a while that, you know, was costing me a lot of money. Hit the 100,000-mile mark on that baby, and it was costing me more in repairs every year than the thing was worth. And I was hot for a Toyota. And so I'm looking around, and at a dealership close by to me, I walk in there, and they got three of the sexiest red Toyotas you ever saw. Mm-hmm. And I like it was just, and I'm not, I wasn't a huge fan of the color red, but it was salsa red pearl. And it was the sexiest red I ever saw. Mm-hmm. And I took it for a ride. It was an SUV. It was a Toyota. It was their sport package. I mean, like, there's everything about this truck. I was completely 1,000% smitten.
Now, when you're riding with this guy, are you hiding your emotions? Or are you just like, hot damn, like, I love this car. Like, what do you do at this point? Are you already in negotiation mode, or what are you doing?
Well, you know, and they did a smart move. I mean, they know that you want the car salespeople know the more time they spend with you, the more likely it is they're going to give in. I mean, mm-hmm. That is the car buyer's art from 6,000 years ago was basically going to waste the salesman's time. All right. So they figured that. They say, I remember that. They say, go and take 3 hours of his time looking at the car you don't want and then switch to another car. And they're going to be so devastated because they spent 3 hours with you that they're going to give in on the other car. Hmm. All right. So overused. Been there, done that. That book is really old. They've all caught on. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? The guy didn't go on the test drive with me. You know, he's not going to spend time with me till we begin negotiating. He's not going to let me soak up his day unless I'm getting ready to get down to negotiate. So he does not go on the test drive with me. The majority of salespeople that have any sense now, when I go into a dealership, they're not going to go on a ride with you because they don't want to bond with you. They don't want you to chit-chat them up. They don't want to drop their guard in any way. So not going on the ride is what they're going to do. So I come back, but now how do I win without making this guy feel beat? I articulate everything he says. I'm like, oh my God, this truck is so beautiful. I'm thoroughly in love with it. And I've already told him that I'm going to write a check for the full amount on the spot if we make a deal, which I'm going to do. So I can't plead, we got a deal going here, and he's reading me as being honest, and I am being honest. Mm-hmm. So I say, they want a 36 for it. I'm going to offer him 30.
Now, did you start with a low anchor at that point?
Well, I started with if I drop a number. It's not an anchor. That's my number. Mm-hmm. I'm not moving off that baby. I don't bargain back and forth. I do everything around bargaining, which is negotiating. So, that's haggling. Hags haggle. We don't haggle.
When do you actually drop in? Do you believe in dropping like an extreme anchor to kind of throw someone off?
I do not. Now, we make emotional intelligence moves. But that's one of the big disagreements that we have with the academics, and our practice backs it up and practitioners back it up. You draw up an extreme anchor, there's a significant chance that the other side is just going to get fed up and shut down, and you will have failed to make a deal that you should have made. Extreme anchors drive away deals that you could have made. What they do is they give you an advantage in the deals where the other side feels like they have to make them. Mm-hmm. But I would say 30 to 40% of the time it drives the other side away, which means extreme anchors cost you money. Mm-hmm. You drive the other side away. You could have made a great lucrative deal. They were insulted. They turned on their heels and walked. You hit me with an extreme anchor, I stop talking to you. Mm-hmm. That's it. We're done. I will go and deal with somebody because I know what you're doing. You're playing games with me, and I don't play games.
So you put out the offer that you said, okay, 30 grand is the most I'm going to spend on this. Like, that's just boom, it's out there. Now
I'm not coming off that number.
Okay.
I'm not anchoring. I'm not coming off my number. When we drop a number, we get our number. And so, but now what he thinks I'm anchoring, plus he's got all his counter arguments. He's all loaded up. So what do I do? That's what empathy is. I articulate their arguments. I don't articulate mine. I articulate theirs.
Give me an example of that.
I said, I said, man, he knows I love the truck. He knows I'm smitten. He knows it's a great price. He knows it's a great value. He knows there aren't any others within 500 miles. Now, I don't know it at the time, but I do an extensive research over the weekend, and I cannot duplicate this truck at this price anywhere else. I literally go to every dealership in a Washington, D.C. metro area.
Now, had you found another vehicle, you know, let's just say one's 50 miles away, would you have mentioned that to him? Or I mean, it's because now it's even rare at this point, right?
Yeah, no, I don't need to make the guy feel backed into a corner. And I come from negotiation where we can perform at our highest level with no options. See, that's the thing a lot of, you know, this BATNA crap. I don't need a BATNA. BATNA is in your mind. BATNA is nonsense. I know why it was thought up by the negotiation project and Roger Fisher in the first place. But in reality, people are taken hostage by BATNA. So if you can let go of BATNA, the freedom is immense. Mm-hmm. I don't need BATNA. Pui on BATNA. I don't need no stinking BATNA. And plus, if I mention it to this guy, he's going to feel backed into a corner. That's going to create a negative residue. And he's going to turn around and pay me back for that first chance he gets.
Right.
I don't need that either. I want a good relationship.
Okay.
I want it all. I want to have it all. I want my cake and eat it too. So what do? I make this guy feel completely understood, which also takes his arguments away from him. I say, you know what? I love this truck. This truck is worth every penny of what you're asking for. The truck might even be priced low as it is. And I'm embarrassed. I feel so embarrassed because he's thinking you should be embarrassed to offer me that. So I say, yeah, I feel embarrassed. I'm embarrassed that I offered you this amount of money because it's beautiful and I love it. I love everything about it. And then I drop the bomb on him. I say, how am I supposed to do that? And he doesn't know what to say. I mean, the guy literally looks at me and blinks. His mind has gone thoroughly blank because I've articulated every argument he had. Now he's got nothing.
Yeah, so he doesn't know if you have, you know, 75K in the bank or you're just barely, you know, or 30,000 one penny, right? So
exactly.
When you say, how am I supposed to do that? Like, how do you, he can't even answer that. What does he come back with?
No, he doesn't. And that's exactly what happens. They will come back with a counter offer. In point of fact, you want to keep saying it to them until they say, if you want the deal, you'll do it. That's when you know you pushed them as far as you could possibly go.
When you push them?
When they say, if you want it, that's what you'll do.
Gotcha.
And you've then done your job. So I'm going to keep saying it until the guy pushes back on me. But instead, he blinks 8 times. His brain starts back up again, and he runs to the back.
Yeah, I love this part here. Let's dig in a little bit because there's a lot that happens in the blinking. You talk about the power of silence. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I got to shut up. I got to let him blink. I got to let his, you know, some people are horrified at silence. I mean, horrified. Or they take it as an opportunity to say some more. You know, you got to let your magic sink in.
And so that just means let him sit with it. You don't say a word. Let him blink. It doesn't matter if it's 30 seconds or 2 minutes, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, again, my son Brandon, he likes to count thousands to himself. You know, 1,000, 2,000, just to keep himself from talking. You know, count thousands to yourself is the bottom line. Because you aren't going to get past 3. I'm telling you, you're not going to get past 3. Mm-hmm. Be prepared to go to 10. They're going to start talking to you before you get to 3. So he blinks and blinks again and blinks again. And finally, he turns on his heel and goes in the back. And he comes back out. I said, hey, he says, man, you know, I talked to my manager. You know, we'll give you a great deal on this 34.5. So now I got to repeat the whole routine again, because I'm like, oh my God, what has he just done? I said, that's so generous of you. I can't believe the truck's beautiful. Again, I go through, it's beautiful. I love it. I can't replace it.
Why repeat it at this point? Cause like, you know, okay, I'm just putting myself in the Kevin sitting in your seat, not you. I would say, well, that's, I can't do that. You know, why do you have to go through it's beautiful. Thank you for the offer. Like what does that pull? What does that change emotionally with him?
Because otherwise he's going to say it, and I want to leave him with nothing to say. And for all intents and purposes, I'm getting a steady dose of that's right over and over.
Oh,
and
like
over.
An internal dose of that's right. So he's right. Like mentally agreeing with you as you're repeating the bullet points that he would have repeated on his own had you not said them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm giving him another hard, solid shot of empathy.
So he's feeling like, oh, this guy gets me. He's you're getting him to kind of subconsciously agree with you. Is that right?
Well, at a bare minimum, I'm not inflaming the situation.
Right.
In hard bargaining, we're used to it being a bare knuckled brawl and it's inflamed and it's emotional, which means negative emotions, which means constricted thinking, which means resentment. It's nothing but bad there. And at my bare minimum is I'm not getting any of that started. And it also puts him in a position of being most likely to comply. So he runs in the back, and now he comes back out with a signed contract with smiley faces on it, and you
they
win.
Always do, they always do that. Point.
Yeah.
At the dealerships, they write smiley faces and all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you. I said, you guys, that truck was worth what you asked before. It's worth more. You're so generous. I can't believe you dropped the price. I'm so embarrassed. I said, I love it, but how am I supposed to do that? And again, he stares at me and blinks some more. Doesn't say
he just
a word.
Keep paralyzing this poor dude.
Yeah, this poor guy. He's blinking. His brain is dropping all his data. He doesn't know what to do. He's got to reboot the system every time.
Yeah.
And now each time he's gone so long, actually my gut instinct is like, I may have come in too high because I'm going to keep this up. He's coming all the way down to my price. I'm getting my number. And he goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And finally, he gives me the number, dollar for dollar, exactly to the penny what I want. So now I spend a weekend. I go, like, all right, so I'll come in on Monday and I'll pay. Because now I'm scared I came in too high. And at one of the dealerships I end up at, I'm like, look, do me a favor. I don't want to waste your time. I got a great price on another Toyota in another dealership. Tell me if you can match it. And a salesman goes, you got a great price? I'm like, yeah, man, I got an awesome price. And he says, well, for the Toyota we're talking about, he says, if you got a great price, you probably got it for around 32. And I'm getting this thing for 30. And I go like, boom, that is all the information I need. I go back down to the dealer. I write the check.
Wow. Now, was there any risk of you losing that deal had you walked away at that point? Because he's probably got to tell you either do this now or it doesn't happen.
Yeah, well, which he didn't. There's always a risk. I mean, anybody that teaches you negotiation and says anything's guaranteed, you know, they're lying to you. There was a guy in Shark Tank. He told the sharks, I got a guaranteed sales process. I can sell anything to anybody. I can sell ice cubes to Eskimos. And the sharks are like, really? And they tore him apart because there are no guarantees. Mm-hmm. But here's a slight nuance on that. We guarantee people, not that they'll make the deal, but we guarantee the best chance of success. Which means you will not succeed every time. We're going to give you a higher batting average than anybody else does.
Yeah, well, that's what I was picking up from the book, which is awesome. That's the way I walked away from it feeling, which is like I've upped my skills quite a bit.
Yeah, and that feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Like I coming from a place that I had zero, it was all like the negotiation skills that I picked up over the years were just all self-taught. You know, no rhyme or reason, no psychology behind them. And I think that's what you deliver on, which is awesome. I do want to touch on round numbers because I thought that was just fascinating. When do you use odd numbers and why?
Round numbers feel temporary. Now you probably, you know, so I mean, like if I say, look, you know, how about $1,000? And you say, well, how about 7,500, because both those numbers feel temporary. Numbers that end in a zero feel temporary.
They don't feel considered, right?
No, that's exactly it. That's right. That's exactly it. They don't feel that there's considered, calculated firmness. And the minute you start going, you know, sometimes even to the penny, at least to an odd dollar, the other side feels that there's something behind it. One of my students from Georgetown is in a rent negotiation. He ends up, when they give him a rent increase, paying less per month than he was paying originally, let alone not paying an increase.
I love that.
And what he does when he's going back and forth on a guy, and three rounds of bargaining, if you're bargaining, if you're haggling, there's going to be three rounds. Diminishing raises on your part each time. Each one has to be less percentage than the last. And then he sits down, he says, give me a piece of paper. And a guy takes a paper and he scribbles a bunch of numbers. Now he's already got the odd number in his head before he goes to this paper scribbling.
So this is just all like to make for the theater of it all, to make it seem like, oh, okay, he's got the pen, he's got the paper, he's actually doing some calculations here and really considering this, right?
He is doing a little bit of theater. Yes, he is. So he writes down a number that he has already PFA'd from earlier in the day, and PFA is plucked from the air.
Right.
Which is like 1973. They wanted, you know, he had been paying 2000. And when he scribbles it down, the guy on the other side goes, "Wow, you must be an accountant." And this kid is not. He goes, "Yeah, I am." I love that. And the guy says, "Yeah, wow, you must be an accountant." He says, "Okay, we got a deal."
Yeah, see, that's crazy, because if you think about, you know, 1973 and the difference between that and, say, 2000 is obviously not that large. But 1973, just the feeling of that number is like, wow, that person, this is what they can afford, because they really went in to the dollar. And that just changes everything, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, it really stops you on the side in your tracks. And then they're like, if they want to throw a counter offer, then I got to put that much work into my number, or my number isn't any good.
Right. And now what about tacking on one additional thing to the offer? Like, okay, I can do 1973 plus, you know, this one thing that really doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that's a master's touch. That's a magician
moment. Yeah, let's see the magician master's, like, what's the icing on top of the weird number?
Well, the other side, then they feel like you're struggling and you really don't have any money left. Now, a lot goes into how you got there. That was, you know, you had to have made diminishing changes, because when each one of your raises, your increases, your moves is a smaller percentage, they feel like they're squeezing you. They feel like they're winning. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, they feel like they're dragging you forward. Each number is a struggle, and you're not counter-offing immediately. You know, you're hemming on your horn, and they took you to this last number, and it seemed like your last dollar, but they can't quite give in. So then you in good faith say, how about my book collection, or how about my tennis shoes, or how about my stereo, or what about a parking space, or
right,
something non-tangible. Which the other side doesn't want. It's got to be something they don't want.
Right.
You know, when we were doing kidnapping negotiations and bargaining over ransom, I'd say, you know, we'll throw in a stereo. what's a terrorist in this jungle going to do with a stereo?
Right. But the thing that it does is it lets you know that you scraped rock bottom, right? There's no more physical funds available, so I will throw in my stereo, right? And they're like, wow, they're throwing in their stereo. They don't really have a whole lot left, right?
Yeah, what if I leave the couch? You know, something stupid.
right. I love that. It's sneaky, but it's just psychology. It's crazy that works, but it does.
Well, you know, one of our rules in negotiation is ignore human nature at your peril.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's certain aspects of human nature that are unavoidable. Mm-hmm. The other side's got to feel like they've won.
Right.
Or you're going to run into problems. I mean, that's an aspect of human nature. You know, when you get into negotiation, and we preach honesty, we preach credibility on a regular basis, and people say, "Well, yeah, are you being honest if you're putting on a show like this?" Or you know, they're hearing stuff that's not exactly what you said, and that's an ongoing dilemma. And my answer to you is, like, if you don't feel like you won, are you going to go through with the deal?
Right.
I mean, even if I feel I won, do I have to make you feel like you lost?
Right.
That's stupid. You know, why am I going to ignore
that's splitting the difference, right?
Yeah, well, that's part of it. That's a whole nother death spiral.
Yeah, splitting the difference that neither party really wins at that point. Neither party feels like they won, right?
Unless the other side's conning you. You know, the old saying, right, in negotiation, a person who offers to meet you in the middle is often a poor judge of distance.
Right.
That splitting the difference is a sucker move in many cases.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, and I know that your book goes into even greater detail, including important things like finding the black swan, which is what your business is based off of. And it's funny, I went to your website, I signed up for I don't know if it was your newsletter, but I got an invite to take part in one of your classes, the online classes. I actually think I'm going to do that next, because I watched a video with your son, and I got to tell you, it seems like your son actually might. I mean, he's brilliant. Like, I feel like he went to the FBI. Like, how is it that you trained him like this? Did he just fall into this line of work as well?
He's a competitive guy. So he's been dealing with me since he was two to start with.
Right.
You know, but the for a son to be successful, they got to outdo the old man. So, you know, he works at this. He loves it. He comes up. And plus, since he actually negotiates on our behalf more than I do, I rarely cut our deals. So he's constantly refining it, you know, on the battlefield. I mean, he's learning about how to refine this stuff. And his favorite thing is to get a nicer room in a hotel than me.
I love that. Does he teach that as part of any of the classes? Because one of the things that I was really drawn to in your book was just like how you can find and get these everyday like little deals. You talked about the Chris special, I thought, which was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is where Chris you say, special. Yeah, is there a Chris special? It was just like a way to kind of like break the ice and get the person to reveal any type of discounts or things like that. Is that something that you guys teach as well?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we get into all that, and we've gotten a lot of our free content on the newsletter, as you mentioned before, and then the online training that we're putting out, we take deep dives into it. So yeah, we teach all that stuff.
Very cool. So where can people find all this? If they want to, obviously they can buy your book on Amazon, but if they really want to go in deep and either, you know, work with you professionally or sign up to your newsletter, what's the best place?
Yeah, the newsletter is a gateway. The newsletter will take you to our website, which is blackswanltd.com. But the newsletter is a real gateway to everything. And the easiest way, it's a text to sign up function. Short, simple, sweet text. You text, the number you text to is 22828. And again, that number is 22828. And the message you send in that text is FBI empathy, all one word. Don't let your spell check put a space between FBI and empathy. It's got to be all one word. Lowercase is fine. Send FBI empathy, all one word, to 22828. If you put it in properly to the right number, you'll get a response back asking for your email. You'll sign up. You will be off to the races with us.
Awesome. Well, Chris, I got to, one, say thank you for kind of, I don't know, just there's so many, I thought I knew what I was doing until I read your book, which I think a lot of people probably, you know, think that they're somewhat, you know, good negotiators or whatever it may be. And you read your book and you just realize that it goes so much deeper. And there's just, like I said, so many gems in that book. So thank you for writing it. And thank you for serving our country too. I think it's the work that you've done is so important. And it's clear that you've saved so many lives in reading your book and hearing all those awesome stories. That's one of the things I didn't mention is it's just packed full of real world negotiations with terrorists and all, and it's just awesome. It's awesome stuff.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's an absolute pleasure being on your show.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
All right. That is it for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, the number one thing you can do is head on over to the iTunes store where the podcasts live. Do search for The Kevin Rose Show and give us a 5-star review. That helps our podcast get recommended to more people. And when more people see it, I get even better guests for the show. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.